Anne ran. But all the poisons, Derek? You know this?
Yes. The water protects the body from any number of things while it's in the bloodstream. But I can't do anything. You know I can't. In my lungs, a beast wants to howl at him. And then that beast in my lungs does howl at him.
No, I don't know. Why not?
I cry.
How could you keep living after this?
He can't do nothing. Derek rises to his feet, yells.
People die. It's what makes you alive.
His breath hits the candle wick. The flame flickers, bounces light around the room, and I realize something.
People die, and people are murdered. It is not the same thing.
I shout back. I almost stand up, forgetting that I am the only thing holding Callum's blood in his body. I don't, though.
Ren, you would have me give up the spring to a man who'd exterminate hundreds just to find it? The death would never end there. What would happen after that? How many wars, do you think, would be fought by others so that they could get to the spring? People like the governor are exactly the reason why the spring must stay a secret.
The death would never end. Derek is right. It wouldn't. All we wanted was more water, back when New York City launched the appeal. And so many people died.
Your friend is gone,
he says again, weary. He walks to the door, knees drenched in red.
Let the spring go with him.
My next words roll out, thunderclouds thick in my mouth. I want you to leave.
Now.
I don't remember thinking them, but looking up, I know it's true. Callum can't be dead. I won't believe it. The room falls quiet. Shadows cover everything. My clothes are soaked, though I no longer feel it. For a moment, I think Derek's left. My head feels so heavy, I have to close my eyes. But his footsteps come up behind me.
I'm sorry.
I think I hear him whisper. And then he kneels again, inches of electric space between his kneecap and my spine. Electric miles separating him from the vial tucked in my back pocket. He leans forward, tells me,
not no one.
And when he does, I swear I taste ashes on my tongue. Chapter 34. 1:30 p.m., Sunday. I'm left alone with Callum's head resting on my lap and a pool of blood beside us. When I tell myself to breathe, I can hear my insides as they rattle apart. Slowly, I rise to my knees. I haven't forgotten what's in my back pocket. But what do? I reach around, keeping my legs bent just enough so Callum's head doesn't slide. Then, I take out the vial. My hands shake.
Don't drop it.
But that just makes me tremble more. So I force another breath of air in and out and wait until I'm steady. My fingers hug the tube, red-stained, but I try to ignore that. Inside, the water looks inconsequential. But the water would fix him. What do? On the floor in front of me, Callum Pace, someone I hardly know. I lower back onto my heels, find myself wishing I knew him better. This boy whose head is sitting in my lap. I brush a few shaggy brown strands out of his eyes and end up smearing his forehead with blood. In my other hand, I hold the vial, Avon's vial. So one day, we can walk outside together on Mad Ave or visit a roof garden. It's for our futures together, our microscopic futures, important to no one but ourselves. If Avon lives, nothing changes. But if Callum lives, so much could change.
Everything.
Derek said the water would keep the poison from working, and Callum knows how to make the real cure. Plus, we've got my blood. We would figure out how to stop the governor. Together. Get the real cure to everyone. First, tonight, before the squadrons fly through. We'd have to find more water, but we could do it. We could end the blight. And it's only even remotely possible if Callum is alive. My sister. Callum. Two lives. One hand. My mind can't piece it together. This choice, it rips my core in half. I look around the room, as if I'll find an answer hiding in the shadows. But I'm only reminded of how alone I am in this. Not even Aven can help me now. This is not a decision I can make. Of course, if Derek's right, Callum is already gone. There's no more choice. It's just Aven. Is it sick that part of me hopes he's right? For fate to leave me with one card and pull away the rest? It's time. I reach for his wrist to feel for a pulse. It's not a choice until there's a pulse. I'm scared of hurting him, so I rotate his palm carefully and place two fingers on his vein. Though I've done it before, it's never been like this. All that learning means nothing. Not when my own racing heartbeat makes it almost impossible to check for someone else's. I wait for some movement through his veins, but all I feel is the hammer of my own heart. Focus. Breathe. Focus. I try again. Two fingers on the vein. I wait. And I wait. And then, after seconds of no movement, the slight bump, bump. I feel it. My heart's got no clue where to go. It rises up into my throat. It barrels down my chest. Relief don't feel like this. But neither does remorse. More salt water beads up behind my eyes. I'm ashamed of myself. But this choice, it's too much. I can't do it. The room begins to spin, hard and fast. When I blink, everything dims, and my stomach heaves. I'm going to retch. I gasp for air, but I can't hear the sounds I make. Just a white, static rush between my ears. I wish I'd never found the water. I can't do this. I can't leave Callum to die. But I can't give up on Aven either. Not when I'm so close. In my head, I hear the governor. My wife is the only person I would kill for. Hours ago, I asked myself if I would do the same for Aven. Now I have an answer. Hating every cell in my body for what I'm about to do, I begin to remove my hand from Callum's side. It's doused. The blood is hot. Burns worse than if it were on fire. I move my palm in millimeters, reaching across his body. For a moment, the vial presses against his cheek. Even more red now. There's so much of it. I ease away, release the pressure from Callum's muscles. The hole in his flesh gets wider. But so many people could be saved. The girl in the contagious ward, with hair bright, like Aven's. More and more red. I don't know when it will stop. I watch and wonder, anxious, unable to take my eyes away, unable to get that girl out of my mind. She's not my Aven. She's a stranger. They all are. And who decided that life was a numbers game? What if some people deserve life more than others? People like Aven. She deserves it more than anyone I know. And I'd rather have one of her than hundreds of strangers. That girl ain't my Aven, but she is somebody else's Aven. My eyes flood up with that thought, and I keep ripping, splitting in two. And then he breathes. A groan, barely audible, so airy it's lost right away. Almost too quiet for me to hear. Almost. I shake my vision clear and look down to meet his eyes, like I should. Except he's not looking at me. I follow his gaze. His eyes are barely open, Just a sliver of blue there. He's looking at the vial.
For Avon,
he whispers, and I choke. He understands. He understands. He's ready to let me give it to someone else, a girl he don't even know. She's not a genius, and she can't develop miracle serums. So why? I don't understand. It wouldn't even be selfish for him to want it for himself. His life equals many lives. It strikes me hard. Avon would do the same thing. Callum isn't her, not by a long shot, but the ward needs more people like Avon. And here I am, ready to leave him to die. The horror of it is a bullet to my chest. I unstopper the vial. How much do I use? Split it in thirds. That's what I'll do. A third on the wound, a third over his broken bones, and the last third he can drink. Hope the serum works better and faster than what I gave Avon. Here goes, I mutter, ripping his shirt to expose the slit along his abs. I use the cloth to wipe away what I can of the blood and hold the vial over the wound. I make sure to pour it deep. Next, I move to reset the bones in his arms. This may hurt like hell, I warn, but he's gone unconscious again and can't have heard me. Still, the sound of my own voice helps keep me sane. So on I talk. Emergency first aid. Never had to use it on myself, which is why the blues taught us. But it's sure going to come in handy right about now. I lift the left arm, snap it back into its rightful position. His face contorts. He groans louder now. But I keep going. Right arm, right leg, left leg, until it's time to apply the serum locally. I pull off his black leather shoes first, then I undo the fancy buckle around his waist. Lifting him up, I start to remove his trousers, making sure the boxers stay on. The pants get caught at his knees, and so I lower him, sliding them the rest of the way. At the sight of his bare legs, I blush and look away. Shirt. He's in no condition to be moved, so I decide to rip off his shirt sleeves. Using the knife I keep strapped in my boot, I slice off one, then the other, exposing long lines of muscle in his arms. I raise a brow, somewhat surprised, and rush to add more drops onto each. I've saved the last of it for you to drink, okay? I don't expect a reply. I just lift his head and bring the vial to his lips. His blue eyes watch me from my lap. I see his brows twinge. He's confused. He doesn't understand why the vial is over his mouth and not Avon's. In that instant, my guilt is a twisting knife. Only his goodness, his confusion, reminds me I must be doing the right thing. It's for you now, I tell him, and feel my eyes turn wet. I leave it at that. He's in no shape to hear or understand why I'm doing this. I tip the vial over his mouth again. He tries to swallow. I watch his throat move, but he coughs and the blood trails from his mouth. I pull away, wait for the spasm to end. Once more, I tilt the vial. I pour the serum. I make sure every last drop finds its way down. Too soon, it's gone. And now we wait, I whisper, eyes glued to the empty glass as Callum drifts off into a fitful rest. I continue to hold his head in my lap, brushing away his hair. I used to do this to Avon. My breath catches at that, and the candle flickers. Yes. With that comes the title, Catastrophic Truth. I've exchanged the two, Callum, for Avon. How could you? Fat tears begin to brim over, and the lump in my throat is a brick I don't know how to swallow. Callum, a boy I hardly know. I choke on the brick, try for air. Palm to forehead, palm to forehead. I run my fingers over the scalp and all the way down. I don't stop. It's automatic. I even find myself searching behind the neck for that spot that always seemed to be growing larger, the lump. I don't find it. And the ears too low. The strands of hair stop short too soon. My fingers tangle free too early. This is hearing your favorite story, the one you know by memory. You've heard it 100 times. Suddenly and differently. I don't stop. Over and over, I shock myself on every different ending. And when I close my eyes to the shadows, try to lose sense of it in the dark, I can't. I can't even pretend I haven't done this. Chapter 35. The spigot's steady dripping becomes the second hand on a clock I don't see. The only reminder I have that time moves forward. When I can't do it anymore, when holding his head becomes a betrayal so sharp I can't stand it, I lift it off my lap and lower him down. He can't be moved now, but when he can, he'll need a place nearby to lie. I drag the mattress from the cot to the bathroom door. Then I take his hand in mine and lie on the mattress myself. I'm alone. I chose it, too. Chose to lose the one person I called family. It was better than family, really. My own blood dropped me on a doorstep. Avon was... She's not dead yet. Drip. 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 Wren. Callum sounds stronger as his voice echoes against the bathroom tiles. But hearing my name in his mouth, it's like hearing my shame speak directly to me. It makes me want to resent him for being alive, using the life I gave him. I swallow the feeling and crawl off the mattress. The choice has been made, and I made it. He will save people. We will save lives together. I'm here, I say, lifting his wrist and wrapping my fingers over his veins to check his pulse again. I can feel it. The beating of his heart. It's stronger now. You're going to be okay, Callum, I whisper, and wait for more words, signs of life. But he's silent again. He's going to be okay, I tell myself. It won't have been for nothing. Keeping his hand in mine, I return to the mattress. More drips. Time passes. I'm not dead. Callum whispers, and my eyes snap open. I must have fallen asleep. Sliding toward him again. Callum? I say, and I squeeze his hand in mine. It's warmer. Hot, even. When I look down, his eyes are open. Big and blue and clear and awake. How do you feel? His eyes dart around the bathroom, land on every corner. I'm not dead, he says again, which I guess is answer enough, and then looking up at the ceiling. How am I alive? He must not remember. On the counter, the candle, wick almost at its end, flickers, hissing into wax. The sound catches his attention, and he watches the shadows in the room like they're ghosts, follows their haunting all the way to his side, to the vial. Now empty. Callum looks at it, moves to sit up, but clutches himself, face in a grimace. Why? He asks, twisting to look at me, head on. I wait to answer, not knowing where to start, but then I hear him inhale, like he's breathed in the answer, through teeth gritted in hurt. The cure, he says, forcing his back against the wall. It's not. I know. It's an extermination plan. A poison pill. I fill in for him. Don't want the words or their meaning on my tongue too long. And with the extremists and the protesters on his back, he'll go through with it. Callum finishes for me, pushing his back farther up the wall, face flushed. We can't let it happen, he says. No, we can't. Callum nods. Closes his eyes. Which is why you saved me. Yes. He's silent, then opens his eyes to stare at the ceiling. Do you have a plan? He asks, monotone. I can hear it in his voice. He don't know what to do with it. The knowledge that I saved him not for him, but for what he can do. I didn't think about how that might make him feel. Get the cure out first? I offer weakly. Now that the serum actually worked, and Callum is here, alive, I shake my head, realizing how weak of a plan it is. We have no more water. And I have no notes, he counters, groaning and throwing a fist into the tiled floor. Not to mention that the cure is a poison. Who's to say the water will counteract it? It will. I asked Derek. He said so. I take his hand. It's clammy in mine, as I unball his fist, one finger at a time. And I know where to find more. That bath I took. Derek had enough water to draw me one, then another, with no worries about rationing. And where else could he constantly keep an eye on things? Callum's eyes flicker toward his hand. My hand. Our hands together. Shifting himself toward me. Let me guess. Derek, your bookie.
My bookie,
I answer, exhaling as Callum closes his eyes once more. My bookie. Derek. No, I correct myself. Someone who would sit by and watch as hundreds are killed. A murderer. Callum walks upstairs after his shower, a towel wrapped carefully around his waist, loose, avoiding the wound. Let me check your side one more time, I insist, and then realize that as he's no longer on death's doorstep, that request is a tad more awkward. Especially the half-naked bit. He rolls his eyes. This is the fifth time I've asked him that. But he walks over anyway and turns to the side, showing me the flesh under his ribcage. You need to leave, he says. Not until I'm sure you'll still be alive when I'm done, I answer, leaning down to get a better look at the wound. I try my best to look at him without looking at him. I feel my face start to burn, but as soon as I get a better look at the almost mortal wound at his side, the embarrassment kind of dies. A gory flesh wound tends to do that sort of thing. By now, the bleeding has stopped entirely. The two folds of sliced skin are taut together, and dark maroon crusts along the line. I whistle my amazement, timid as I press my fingers around the worst of it. Well, I say, standing up, the serum definitely works on wounds. Enough of those phytohoozits, it would seem. Faster than the original stuff, without a doubt. Callum smiles and looks down at his torso like he's pleased with his work. And with pure, unmuddied water, I'll be able to do even more, I think. He walks over to his suitcase to pull out clean clothes. Will you still need my blood, do you think? I ask, turning away from him so he can change. I walk over to the mess by his table, and with my fingers wrapped in a washcloth, I try to collect half-broken test tubes and droppers, and whatever else looks even remotely usable. I'm only slightly worried about him needing my blood to make the cure. With a few hundred sick to heal, I don't know if I have it in me. Literally, have enough blood in me to be up to the task. Callum looks at me and inhales. As all of my notes have been destroyed, it's hard to say. But Ren, after you left, I ran more tests. The way your blood interacted with the virus, I've never seen anything like it. Not only did it break down the viral cells, but somehow, and I'm still foggy on this point, it stimulated Milo's own immune response. And if my observations are correct, your blood actually improved how the recipient was able to synthesize the spring water's chemical compounds. A pause. He raises one brow like he don't understand it himself. Your blood is different. Different how? I don't know. He shrugs, then says, but your blood has served you well these 16 years, so clearly it's nothing to be concerned about. I nod, if he says so, and pack away the last of what was salvageable into his suitcase. He's ready to take off. The lab is still a disaster. Glass shards on the floor, tubing cut into pieces. It's as good as it's going to get. Call me when you have a new location, I say. He throws me a look that reads, of course, now get out of here. I take the keys to his Omni. Can I ask you to do one more thing for me? He meets me by the door, and I turn to find him holding something in his hand. Anything, he says, and I can see he means anything, though what I'm about to ask doesn't require that much. You're a doctor. The hospital knows you. If you asked for Avon's status, they'd tell you the whole truth, no sugarcoating. I want you to contact them for me and find out how she's doing. Callum nods. Absolutely. I'm happy to. I'll get an update from them as soon as you leave, and I'll calm you straight away. Anything else? Nope, I say, one hand on the doorknob. I'm about to step out when I feel his arm on my shoulder. Wait, Ren? He pulls me back gently, and when I turn around, there's an openness to his face that I'm not sure I've ever seen before. Not that he's always closed off. He's just the serious, bookish type, head always off someplace, figuring out confusing things. What you did before? Callum starts, shuffling his feet and shaking his fist. It's still holding something that I can't see. We don't know each other, and you didn't have to do it. It wasn't for me. I know that. He waves his hand to dismiss me before I even have a chance to speak, then continues. You saved me because I can save others. We can save others, he corrects himself. I just want you to know, I'm going to make it worth it. For you. Avon's not lost. You didn't choose me over her. You chose both. I promise. I smile, but his words, they make me want to cry. The happy kind, but also the not-so-happy kind. I don't like him thinking that he's just a means to an end. I do care about him, of course. Though I don't know him well, he's a good person. That much I can see. I make my hand into a fist just so I can bite it to stop the tears. Callum turns up his palm. In it, he's holding a shiny copper penny. I saw at the race you already have one. He glances at my necklace. Nonetheless, thank you, he says, gesturing for me to turn around so he can add it to the chain I'm already wearing. It's store-bought, unfortunately, he goes on. Not like the other you're wearing. I don't expect it's any less lucky, though. I open my mouth. Not that you need luck, of course, he adds casually. I'm quite certain you get along perfectly well without it.
Good skill.
I can almost hear Avon saying it to me right now, like she's speaking to me through him. Or maybe it's that they just think the same. For the first time in days, I smile, with Avon's voice right there. Thank you, I say, rubbing the penny between my fingers. Thank you.
Good skill.
Chapter 36. 4:15 p.m., Sunday. A red path mazes across the screen of the Omni's dash. Remnants of the old city pass by in the windowpane, and it's like someone's taken out Time's batteries, left everything frozen in place. The underwater city is always like this. I imagine it's different over in the West Isle, where so many people have mobiles that the canals actually get congested. Here, though, it's dead quiet. My cuffcom buzzes. It must be Callum getting back to me about Avon. I pull one hand from the steering wheel, still there despite the autopilot. I read the message. She's stable, and though the mass's rate of growth has slowed, it's dangerously close to damaging her long-term brain function. Translation, fine for the time being, not fine if we can't help her soon. I swallow and pretend that the world is frozen, no ticking, above the surface. Avon has days that don't become hours, that don't become seconds. Soon. I'm holding in my breath, like holding in life. I sit back. I do nothing, my hands on the wheel nonetheless. Though the Omni moves easily through the water, I'm not used to letting a machine make all the decisions. But right now, it's a blessing to be able to turn off my head. I don't want to make any more decisions. Focus. I need to stay focused. After a few minutes, the voice nav announces that I've arrived at my destination. The spring could be anywhere, though. Can't just walk in. What would I say? Please pass the Fountain of Youth. Thanks.
Not going to work. I'm just gonna have to look around. But down here, nothing is familiar. There are no obvious landmarks. My sense of direction has flown out the window. If I knew the difference between this pylon and that pylon, maybe I'd have some idea. But they're all brown, covered in green gunk. Nonetheless, voice nav doesn't lie. I turn right into an alleyway flanked by two buildings' brick foundations. The space between is so narrow, I couldn't lie down sideways without having to bend my knees. The buildings are maybe only 4 feet apart. Callum's mobile better be small enough. It's a later model Omni, putting it at about 3 feet 9 inches, so I should be good. But I still drive slow, gripping the wheel too hard. The mobile shakes, nearly bangs into the brick siding. Why is she shaking so bad? I look down at my grip. My fingers are the problem. His Omni's just answering the command. My hands never get the shakes during a race. Before sometimes, but not during. Now, though, my nerves physically hurt. Every last one is a razor, ready to slice. Breathe. I force air into my mouth, down my lungs. Repeat. Repeat. Listening to the sound. It's because there are too many people at stake. Too much responsibility. I don't like it. Don't know where to put it. And Avon's life is riding on this, too. My one more shot at saving her. I turn off the headlights in favor of the belly lamp, not wanting to draw too much attention. Actually, I'd rather keep the lights off entirely. It's safer. But then I really might run into the building's side. Everything under me turns bright green as the Omni hovers alongside the walls. I search for a window, or anything, just a way to make it inside the building and get scouting. But then, there. A glint of silver? What would be silver down here? You could store a mobile, I guess, but it would be hard to get at when you needed it. And if it weren't being used on the regular, it wouldn't be silver. Metal, plastic, you name it, it all gets covered in green underwater funk almost immediately. I hit reverse, trying to catch the light again. Nothing. Nothing. There. And it disappears. The alley is no more than algae and concrete blocks and brick turned green. Seaweeds move with such sway, if I weren't so adrenaline-amped, I might find it soothing. Again. I'm along the straight's floor now, and I've lost sight of the glint. But over there, caught underneath a pile of rubble, I think I see a tangled fishing net. Normally this wouldn't catch my eye, but there's nothing else like it down here. And it's the perfect place to cover something metal, something silver. This wasn't exactly in the plan, but then again, nothing was. I know what to do next, but I'm not looking forward to it. Dimming the belly lamp, I hop into the back seat, then dig around the neoprene suit that I know is back here. After all, this baby has an airlock hatch. When I find the neatly folded suit, I quickly strip out of my clothes and slide myself into the skin-tight fabric. It was obviously made for a guy, long in the legs and puffy in the shoulders and groin. The thought of Callum's thing having been right here makes me snicker. I can't help but pat the bulgy space. He must have had it made special order. The rest of it may be small enough, but this space, not small. Tucked into a net on the roof, I find a rubber storage pack. I pull it down and throw it on like a backpack, then fold the extra neoprene underneath itself. Last, I crank at the hatch in the back, crawl into a space no bigger than I am, and curl into a ball. How would a guy fit in here? Then again, Callum is pretty slim. Derek couldn't fit. Who knew they made mobiles that came in a size small? My head and hands are going to be exposed, but so long as my core stays warm, my temp should be fine. I know I should take off my Hessians. They'll only weigh me down. But we've been through so much together. I can't abandon them now, not when I'm finally doing something worthwhile. I leave them on and push the red button and take a deep breath. The bottom retracts. I'm back in the water. After the second or two it takes to shake off the pesky feeling of being knifed by ice water, I focus myself.
My Hessians drag me down, and I don't have to swim to the floor. A happy accident thanks to my stubbornness. I reach out for the net, but it's slick, slippery, and coated by algae, and we grapple with each other. I defeat the monster, though, in the end, tossing it to the side once I free it from the bricks. Then I see the thing that glinted. Another hatch. An underwater entrance for docking omnis or subs is unusual but not unheard of. Still, it warrants some poking around. I brace myself, steadying my legs against the wall, and with both hands I try to rotate the latch. Air bubbles drift away from me. How long can I go without breathing? The latch won't budge. To the right, I see a small device glowing neon green under the water. I flip it open, and on the screen, a series of shapes appears. Square, triangle, circle, dot. What do I do? Seconds float by, each one seeming longer than the last. I'll need air soon. I look at the shapes again. Then, to see what happens, I tap the square. It slides down onto the middle of the screen, blinking, waiting for me to do something else. I drag it back to the row of shapes because I know it's not right. I need the circle. Using the pad of my finger, I drag the circle down. Next, the dot. But there's no line. Without a line, how can I draw the tattoo? I look closer. The square. Dragging the bottom line, I lay it directly over the dot, across the middle of the circle. I'd hold my breath, but I already am. Air bubbles drift up from the circular hatch in front of me. Must have done it right. I try twisting the wheel-shaped handle again and find myself spinning it to the left. In a rush of air and water, the latch makes one final rotation, and with a heavy click, it automatically rises. Suction pulls me into an indoor pool. I can almost breathe. Behind, the latch lowers. I try to get some air, but the Hudson water hurtles over the closing door in a waterfall, pushing me down. I can't stand until the airlock pressurizes, and there's no more water coming in. When the door finally locks, suctioning closed with a heavy sigh, I'm standing waist-deep in the pool. In front of me is yet another latch. I inhale the dank smell a few times. If I weren't so short on air, I'd be plugging up my nose. The swampy rankness ain't exactly pleasant. I inspect the other circular door. It's got no latch, no way to open it. Below my feet, the metal flooring groans. It slides away, and I'm left standing on a grate, allowing the water to drain away. Soon as the last of the water disappears, the hatch opposite slides up. And wasting no time, I step through. Chapter 37. 4:40 p.m., Sunday. Dust-covered black pianos. Gold-painted chairs stacked high, leaning to the side on top of a plush velvet sofa. Rolled-up carpets in every corner. Trunks with brass handles. Destinations papered to their sides. Stuff. Everywhere. The space is huge, probably bigger than the inside of the tank. I'd call it the basement, but basements don't look like this, even if that's what it is. This room looks kinda like how I'd imagine the inside of a dragon's lair. I know I shouldn't waste time, but my eyes don't know what to do with everything. I want to know what all of it is, when Derek got it, since you can't buy most of this stuff nowadays. I can't help myself. I pick my way through, until I see a small desk leaned up against the exposed brick. On it, albums. Stacks and stacks of albums, all dusty and worn. I find the one that looks the oldest, and open to the first page, a faded black and white photo. It's not dated, but the somber faces tell me this was taken before people started smiling in pictures. Three men stand beside three women, all dressed to the nines. For the men, waistcoats and tall hats. The women, though, wore half American Indian garb, half white settler fashions, poofy embroidered dresses, but also strands and strands of beads. Feathers dangle from their hair, while pearls dangle from their ears. Moccasins for their feet, and stockings for their legs. I lean in closer. The first and second couple I don't recognize at all, though one of the men looks a lot like Derek. But the last, even without color, I know the distinct glint of his copper hair. I almost drop the pack dangling over my shoulder. Why the brack is he still alive? Guardian of a magical healing spring was one thing, but this is immortality. Maybe I should have known. Maybe I did know. Somewhere in the way back of my mind, it's just seeing him like this. It changes everything. I can't deny it or ignore the possibility. I choke, cough, and in my stomach, a snake pit. I can feel it writhing. I'm writhing. He guards the water from people like Avon who need it, and yet here he is, alive, for centuries. No wonder he's quick to let us die. He's juiced up on a spring that keeps him young, no expiration date. But the picture shows me more than just that. I keep looking, hunched over the album. Next to Derek, a woman stands straight, fearsome and commanding despite her lack of height. Glossy, pin-straight, liquid metal. It's Kitana, and his hand rests on her shoulder. His hand. Her hand. Gold bands on the fourth fingers. They're married. My eyes water, but like watching some horrible accident, I keep riffling through the album, page after page, Derek and Kitana, him in the militia, her the good colonial wife. Decade after decade, she's smiling, sequined. He's got a floppy grin on. New York City in the 1920s, 30s, on and on. I slam the album shut and start opening drawers left and right, looking for, who knows what, more of the story? More answers? Forcing myself to breathe, I push down the feeling that I'm about to be sick. He kissed me. How could he? The drawers are mostly empty or filled with papers. Except for one. In it, a small wooden box with words carved on the lid. Bellum Pesti. I can't read the rest, so I reach down. Brack. Crisscrossed red laser lights web across the drawer. Overhead, a siren sounds. But the water! I found nothing. Except, there's no time. Beelining to the airlock, I push aside ottomans and guitar cases, framed paintings and old leather trunks. The hatch is closing all on its own, even though I left it open specifically so I can make a quick getaway. The alarm must have triggered it. I duck low to the floor, and sticking my feet through first, wiggle myself back into the pressurized room. With only 2 inches to spare, and still in one piece, I get no chance for relief, though. My feet, they're losing their balance. The grate slides away, opens up to a cavernous, water-filled space below. I fall to one side, avoiding the gap. Pretty soon, though, there's going to be nowhere left to stand. Then, from a dozen nearly invisible vents, clouds of vapor fog up the room. What the hell is that? I hold my breath as long as I can, while trying to keep my footing. Looking down, I notice that not only is the grate moving, the water that drained down earlier is now rising up. I reach for the handle on the first hatch and turn, expecting it not to budge. The wheel rotates. Easily. This makes me stop. Too easy. It makes no sense. Unless whatever just came out of those vents was supposed to do something to me, but failed. Something tells me not to take the bait. Something also tells me not to stand around like an idiot. Call it a hunch. Call it intuition. I think there's a spring down there, wherever that water is coming up from. I brace myself, glad I'm wearing Callum's neoprene suit, and kneel at the edge. Then I dive roll in. My forehead, and after that my cheeks, are the first to burn from the freeze. Neoprene keeps the rest of me warmish, but it's still a shock. A few feet down, and light's just a memory. I flick open my cuffcom and activate the laser light on the side. It's small, not made for this sort of thing, but bright enough to shine a path. Too bad my frog stroke ain't exactly conducive to keeping a beam steady. Every time my left wrist pushes through the water, the light shines backward in the opposite direction. I wish I had one of those silly flashlights that you attach to your head. Though, I know I'm swimming deeper. The temperature doesn't seem like it's getting colder. Warmer, maybe. But definitely not colder. My eyes start to burn from the brack water, but this tunnel is too small for me to want to keep my eyes shut. Then, the first pang of air hunger hits. I swallow the gasp my body wants to take, and keep on. Eventually, my fingers stop grazing the sides. The space widens. I wave my wrist ahead, just in time to follow the change in direction. A curve, and I'm swimming back toward the surface. My Hessians drag me down. I should leave them. Kick them off. Never. Now we've really been through too much together. Air hunger pang two. I open my mouth a bit, let some air escape. That helps, like there's less pressure inside me. As I close my mouth, I notice the water. It doesn't taste salty. Once more, I take in the tiniest bit. Sure enough, the taste is sweet. Somewhere in this tunnel, the water went from bitter brackish to fresh. I must have hit another pocket that bleeds into the strait, mixing together. Then, all of a sudden, I'm warm. Warmer than warm. The neoprene has locked in my heat, and I'm actually sweating. I must be close, but even with the light from my cuffcom, there's no way to be sure. I keep pulling myself up and up. Through the blur, I must be imagining it. The sides of the tunnel seem to be glowing. Bright green? Dots of speckled neon. Just as I grapple with air hunger pang three, my head breaks the surface. I gasp, sucking down air, fighting the wave of dizziness that follows. My arms flail, exhausted, and my beloved boots keep trying to drown me. But looking around, I see I was right. Under the surface, all around me, the walls of the cavern are spotted with the stuff. I dunk my head again and swim closer. Through the underwater blur, the stuff is unidentifiable. Some sort of plant, I think, but what do I know? So I pluck a few from the side of the wall's slick mushiness and swim back for air. Once I'm breathing again, I look down into my palm. The neon green spots? They're tiny glowing mushrooms, with droopy tent-like caps and nearly invisible stems. So basically, aliens. These must be the plants that the phytothingies come from. I should take a whole bunch of them, because if I'm right, they're probably going to have the antiviral goodies that the spring water was missing. And I guess the jury's still out on whether Callum will be needing my blood for this evening's science experiment. I swipe a few fistfuls of the extraterrestrial buggers from the tunnel walls for him, then pull the waterproof sack from my side to fill up with fresh. The weight of the sack, plus the liquid inside, drags me under slightly. The trip back will take longer, for sure. I don't wait. Sliding the sack over my shoulder, I take one final breath of air and dive under, following the cavern back the way I came. My cuffcom lights the way, enough so that I don't swim into the sides. I keep my feet kicking and wait for the air hunger pangs. Every few strokes, I stick my tongue out. The longer I taste the sweet, the more anxious I become. Return trips always pass quicker, I remind myself. This time, when the temperature shifts suddenly to cold, I feel it like a glacier. I'm chilled straight through despite the neoprene, and soon, my fingers are numb. Then, the first hunger pang hits. I'm ready for it. I know how to swallow it, choke it back down to where it came from. I feel the round of the curve, start to swim up again. When I stick my tongue out again, the water finally tastes normal, like brack. I'm close. Time passes. I'm gonna make it. I can see light coming from the pressurized room's ceiling, and the tunnel has started to narrow. My fingers graze the sides. One final push forward. I reach for air. The light's right there, right on the ceiling. But instead, my fingers graze metal. I'm touching the ceiling. How am I touching the ceiling? Then I remember. When I dove into the tunnel, the space filled up after me. I open my mouth. I swallow gulps of brack water because there's no air in the room. None at all.
Chapter 38. 5 p.m., Sunday.
My chest spasms. A burning spreads throughout. Backpedaling through the water, I reach for the first latch. Using hands I can't feel, I rotate. The door lifts up and I shimmy myself underneath, finding myself outside the building once again, 100+ feet to the surface. Not too far off, the thrum of an engine stirs the underwater silence. As the dull sound grows clearer, I'd bet money it's not just everyday canal traffic. A bright beam of light like a neon green laser cuts through the murk. Whoever's in that mobile is cutting beneath the boardwalk. Not a good sign. So I swim upward, again fighting the weight of my Hessians. I kick and kick, but they weigh me down like boulders. "You're staying on my feet, you hear?" I tell the both of them, pulling myself closer to the purple Omni. That bright beam closes in, shines on me directly. I feel like an underwater Santa with his big red sack over my shoulder. Whoever is manning that other mobile will see me too. The engine thrashes my way. I dive under Callum's mobile, where I pull myself into its belly and close the bottom barrel door. At the telltale muted click, I push another button, green this time, and immediately start gagging, retching up water, while the water trapped in the hatch gets sucked out a series of one-way pipes. It drains away in a rush, and I damn near have a make-out session with the roof. I'm so starved for air. Within moments, only an inch or so of water is left in the airlock crawl space, but I've got no time. A tide sweeps by, rocking the Omni, and I open the hatch into the pit. The floor will flood slightly, so be it. Just then, my neck jolts forward, whips back. A garbled crunch. Then I see the other mobile, also an Omni, sleek and black, lurching from the collision. Oh no. I shove in the key and hit the acceleration, not caring about a case of repeat whiplash. My Omni jolts forward, but it feels heavier, like it's dragging in the back. Bright neon draws my eye to the dashboard. On the screen, an outline of Callum's Omni flashes. The airlock hatch flashes too. Both red. That crunch I heard wasn't just external damage. The airlock is filling up with water. It's gonna drive slower than it ought to. I check the steam and gas levels. Both are in good supply. Still, I hope it can get up enough speed. I keep driving straight, knuckles bone white against the wheel. Above, a circular brass button. If that is what I think it is, I push it. Yes! A brass periscope extends downward. The lens falls to about eye level, for someone not 5 feet tall. I curse all the non-vertically challenged Omni manufacturers out there. If I lift my butt up, I can easily see the other mobile behind me. I force myself to ease my grip on the wheel. Notice I'm holding my breath. Again. I exhale, willing a slower rhythm onto my heart. Whoever's riding me, there may be only 15 feet back. I can do this. I've made it so damn far. I'm Santa. I have the water. I remind myself of that fact, thinking it'll comfort me. But instead, it sets my nerves wild. I've just reminded myself how much there is to lose. Now it's not just Avon. It's every HBNC-infected person in the ward. But that very thing that set my nerves off is the same thing that calms them. I think of Avon. How she'd scold me first for landing myself in this mess, and next give me a kiss on the cheek for finally doing something she'd approve of. That makes me laugh. The other mobile and I are both stuck in this narrow alley. Brick walls on either side and only a few inches of wiggle room. One sideways rip and I'm crunchy toast. But I have to turn soon. If I keep straight, I'll end up in a suicidal brick maze of gutters like this one. Not smart. I need to get under an avenue. I tear my eyes away from the periscope and buckle myself into the seat. This is gonna hurt. Turning off the back props entirely, I wrestle with the wheel as the mobile slows. "Don't hit the walls now," I say out loud, and flick on the belly props. The Omni shoots up to the surface. I still need to get out of here, though, and the nearest avenue is behind me. There's also no room to turn around. Looks like I'm going to have to steer upside down. The teensiest, most minuscule part of me is excited. I've always wanted to do this. Never could, what with my Rimbo and all. I just wish it didn't have to happen now. There's a bit too much on the line for me to be entirely comfortable with death-defying mobile stunts. But it's the quickest way out. I pull back on the steering wheel, angling her up, up, and over. Soon enough, I'm dangling from my seat. The belt digs into the tops of my thighs. I feel myself slipping, but my butt will hold me well enough. At the beeping noise, I look around the pit, then realize it's coming from my cuff comm. It's gotta be Callum. I can't look now, though. I jam on the accelerator. Propelled forward, my Omni grazes over the other's domed glass roof. I won't slow down. I'm not that stupid. And really, I don't need to see her face. I only need one guess. The girl looks up through the glass, and even if all I saw was her long, straight black hair, I'd recognize her. But I see the eyes, too. Coal dark, set beneath high, arched eyebrows. It's Kitana. Shocking. Anger snakes through my chest. The girl tried to kill Callum. She watches me hurtle past. Maybe I am that stupid. I blow her a kiss, then shove my middle finger up against the glass of the roof. My Omni takes off for Mad Ave. If I can get her to follow me underneath the boardwalk, the super-crowded with innocence boardwalk, I'm hoping that she won't want to risk an accident. I'm just hoping that there's a heart in there, somewhere. Even though she kills people by protecting a spring that could save people. I know what she said, about it not being medicine, but she gave me no reason. Why not? Why can't it be? Either way, all's I know is that she wants back what I've got in my rubber sack. I race to the end of the building, aiming to cut an L around it, and lift the Omni closer to the walkway. Blood rushes to my head, and I feel like gravity is going to drop me out of my seat, but the belt holds tight. This move is a gamble, but Kitana is way closer than she should be. Clearly, I've angered the beast. Then I feel the waves rocking behind me, even with my lead. A quick glance in the periscope shows me that she's pulled the same upside-down whirligig. I wheel to the right, or left, since I'm upside down. In the semi-open water beneath the boardwalk, I straighten out the Omni. The veins in my head, practically mountains growing out from my forehead by now, return to normal size. And the relief of all the blood flooding back to its proper places nearly blacks me out. I'm only a few feet below the walk when I see the shadow of her Omni behind me. On the dash, my voice nav screen lights up, shows me TV Snow. But I didn't turn it on. Omni to Omni com request, do you accept the transmission? The nav system synth voice asks me. I look at the gray screen, unsure. This is not a feature my Rimbo has, nor is it one I want Benny to install, ever. Do I accept? All she's going to do is try to convince me to give the water back. That, or she'll tell me that she's going to kill me, neither of which I care to hear. But I'm curious. Yes, I say, and it still feels strange speaking into the air. The snow flickers in and out, is replaced by Kitana's face, cool and unfazed, on my dash. You accepted, she says, arching her brows. Then, with a nod, thank you. Not quite the reaction I'd expected. I think, realizing how little I know about this girl, this ancient girl, and all of a sudden I feel bad for her. I feel bad that she married Derek, and that he would go behind her back kissing girls like me, who are like 3% her age. You're welcome, I answer, quietly. The screen goes gray for a moment, then all I hear is her voice. Please, she pleads, and I'm sure I look as shocked as I'm feeling. She's saying please? Then her voice grows harder. You think you're doing the right thing, and perhaps... She cuts out, but it's not because of the connection. She stopped speaking. When her face returns to my dash, she looks desperate. Tired.
Perhaps you're right, she says. But the risk is too great. Governor Voss is no fool. Until the airdrop happens, he'll be waiting for us. He'll be on the lookout to see what we do.
Though Katana is probably right, he will be. I'm too close to give up. The sack is full. My sister's life is in there, and so are all the other sick. I'm sorry, I say, reaching for the button to drop the call. Just before I press it, I hear, forgive me. The line goes silent. I check the periscope again. She's still way too close. I have to lose her. So I zigzag. The best thing to do when someone's coming after you like this. You can't just zigzag, though, because then that becomes a pattern, and they'll just catch on. I weave between the boardwalk's pylons, mixing it around, 1-1-1, then skipping 2 or 3, and crossing over to the other side's row. I can't keep this up. The tank holds only enough gas to keep the steamer boiling water. It'll be empty soon. Is that her plan? Skunk me out till I got no place to go but hell in a handbag? Her Omni don't have laser guns or anything, so it's not like she could blow me out of the water. Then it dawns on me. That's exactly what she'll try and do. I know full well she'd like to end me. All she's got to do is keep tailing me until I blow me out of the water. Collide with something, a wall, a pylon, anything hard enough to make smithereens of me. Okay, I think. I can work with that. Once more, I reach for the periscope. I bring my eye to it. But I'm too late. All I see is the bullet-shaped nose of her Omni clipping my tail. My own Omni careens forward. I twist the wheel away from pylons, but one of them swipes my side anyway. If this were above water, I'd be setting off in a tailspin to the moon right now. But we're not, so the mobile just reels out, then slows.